All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Vinaya Krishna Prasthaya Budhale. Srimati Bhaktivinoda Swami Niti Namani Namaste Saraswati Devi. Gauravani Pachani Nivasesa Sinivani Paskatya Desa Charani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Utapta Kamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavams Chasi Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitams Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitams Cha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
February 15th, 2013, in Cape Town, South Africa, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 9, The Lord Incarnates as Mohini Murti, texts 13, 14, and 15. So 14, 15 are on the board. I'll just read through text 13. Itya vyaritam tasya akarnya surapungava apramana vidastasyas The chiefs of the demons were not very expert in deciding things. Must be, because if they were expert in deciding things, they wouldn't be demons. Right? Upon hearing the sweet words of Mohini Murti, they immediately assented. Yes, they agreed. What you have said is all right. Thus the demons agreed to accept her decision. So again, their agreement wasn't deep when they were saying, yes, you can do whatever you want, as we discussed yesterday. It wasn't because they actually were willing to have her do whatever she wanted. They were thinking that that was a temporary bargaining agreement to get with it. Well, okay, I'll agree to do whatever you want, so you'll agree later to do whatever I want. It wasn't real surrender. Okay, let's just read through text 14.
Ato posya kritasnana. Utvachaha visanalam Dattvago virprabhutebhya Kritta swasyayana dvijay.
I guess I'll do the other ones up there also.
Yato payosham vasamsi Paridaya hataniye Kusheshu pravishan sarve Prag agreshva bibushita.
Please chant.
Kusheshu pravishan sarve.
Thereafter, Uposha, observing a fast, Kritya Snanaha, performing bathing, Kutva, offering oblations, Cha, also, Havisha, with clarified butter, Analam, into the fire, Dattva, giving in charity, Go Vipra Bhute Bhya, unto the cows, brahmanas, and living beings in general, Krita Swasyaya Naha, performing ritualistic ceremonies, Dvijay, as dictated by the brahmanas, Yata Upa Joshyam, according to one's taste, Vasamsi, garments, Paridhyaya, putting on, Ahatani, first class and new, Te, all of them, Kusheshu, on seats made of kusha grass, Pravishan, sitting on them, Sarve, all of them, Prak Agreshu, facing east, Abhibhushitaha, properly decorated with ornaments. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The demigods and the demons then observed a fast. Okay, so they're about to get the nectar distributed. So they didn't just say, okay, let's just do it. And they go through a procedure. Okay. The demigods and the demons then observe a fast. After bathing, they offered clarified butter and oblations into the fire. And yeah, I'm going to ask you all the things they did. And gave charity to the cows and to the Brahmins and members of the other orders of society, namely the Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Sudras, who were all rewarded as they deserved. Thereafter, the demigods and demons performed ritualistic ceremonies under the directions of the Brahmanas. Then they dressed themselves with new garments according to their own choice, decorated their bodies with ornaments, and sat facing east on seats made of kusha grass. Okay? What did they do? First, they fasted. Okay? They put ghee in the fire. Well, before they did that, they took a bath. So they fasted, and they took a bath. Then they put ghee in the fire. They gave charity to brahmanas and cows and everybody. Okay? Then they dress themselves nicely with new fresh clothes according to their own taste. Okay. And then put on ornaments. And then they sat facing east on kusha grass. Very good. Hey, purport. The Vedas enjoin that for every ritualistic ceremony, one must first become clean by bathing either in the water of the Ganges or Yamuna or in the sea. How far are we from the sea? Not far. 15 minutes? A little hard to go there every morning, though, huh? Yeah. Okay. Then one may perform the ritualistic ceremony and offer clarified butter into the fire. In this verse, the words paridhaya, ahantani, are especially significant. A sannyasi, or a person about to perform a ritualistic ceremony, should not dress himself in clothing sewn with a needle. Ato posya kritasnana utvacha abhisanalam
Tatvago Vibrabhu Tebhya Krita Swastha Yayan Krita Swast Yayana Dvijay Yato Payosham Vasamsi Paridaya Tantantite Kusheshu Pravisan Sarve Prag Agreshu Abhibhushitaha.
The demigods and demons then observed a fast. After bathing, they offered clarified butter and oblations into the fire and gave charities to the cows and to the brahmanas and members of the other orders of society, namely the kshatriyas, vaishyas, and sudras, who were all rewarded as they deserved. Thereafter, the demigods and demons performed ritualistic ceremonies under the directions of the brahmanas. So they did twice. They performed, first they offered oblations in the fire, then they distributed charity, then they did more ritualistic functions. Then they dressed themselves with new garments according to their own choice, decorated their bodies with ornaments, and sat facing east on seats made of kusha grass. So we do have some people in the world today who are really into rituals. I mean, everybody in one sense has rituals. You can start noticing, you know, like if people wear pants, like which leg they put on first, or which sock you put on first, or which shoe you put on first, or like how you fold your hands. You know, some of us do it this way and some of us do it this way. And we have little rituals, we do. And if you have to change them, like if you hurt one of your hands or one of your feet or something, you have to do things differently. It's very disconcerting. And we all have little habitual things that we go through, little rituals. And these are rituals that we've, each of us have developed by training from our parents, because of our society, or just somehow or other. We just started doing these things. And we continue to do them because they give some order and structure to our life, and we feel that they'll give us happiness. And then there are people who are really into other kinds of rituals, particularly religious rituals. And that seems to be decreasing in the world. It seems to be going down. This concept of having religious rituals. And this exists in every religion. And it's particularly interesting, I don't mean to pick on them, but it's just particularly interesting about the Christian religion. Because if you know something about the history of religion, so the Christian religion, Jesus was not Christian, of course. Jesus was Jewish. And the Jewish religion has 613 rules. It's really interesting. They say that people who are not Jewish, I think they only have to follow like 6 or 7 rules, and Jews have to follow 613. So if you're not Jewish and you want to become Jewish, they try to talk you out of it. They say, you know, you can go to heaven with just like 6 or 7 rules. Why do you want to follow 613? But it's interesting. Jesus said in the Sermon of the Mount, if you can take that those are his actual words, that he said, I haven't come to destroy the laws. Until the end of the creation, not one bit of the laws will pass away. But then Jesus' grand disciple, Paul, decided that he wasn't satisfied with just preaching to Jews and just preaching within Judaism, that he wanted to spread the teachings of Jesus to non-Jews. And he felt that the non-Jews would not be willing to accept the rules of Judaism as a prerequisite for following Jesus. So he basically threw them all out. I mean, all of them. You know, it was Paul who said, it's not what you eat that contaminates you, it's what you say. Of course, that was brought up to Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said that was ridiculous. He said, so if you eat stool, you're not contaminated. If you eat your mother, you're not contaminated. What is this? But why did he say that? Because there were dietary rules that the Jews were following. Just like here in South Africa, you have quite a lot of Indian, particularly Indian Muslims, right? And they have certain rules on what they can eat. So he threw out the rules. Now, what's particularly interesting in this connection is then all of a sudden you had a society without religious rituals. Interesting. They had thrown out all the Jewish religious rituals, and they started their own religion, but they had no rituals. They had no real scripture either. I mean, they had the Old Testament of the Jews, but they didn't have their own scripture. And so after Christianity became larger, after it had more people in it, and it became more organized, usually as a religion, usually, not always, but usually as a religion gets larger, it gets more organized, they started saying, hey, we need our own scripture, and we need our own rituals. Interesting, huh? So they put together their own scripture. Basically, the New Testament is a compilation of the writing of leading Christians.
And then where were they going to get their ritual? Where did the rituals in Christianity come from? All different places. They took a little bit of this, and they took a little bit of that, and a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, and they put together their own rituals. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, I find it fascinating. And it became embedded. So that if you're a Christian, you need to do this. And of course, different sects developed their own rituals, so there was a big split between the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church, and they have somewhat different rituals. Similar, but somewhat different. The rituals of the Eastern Orthodox are closest to our Vaishnava rituals. And then you have the Protestant group that threw out a lot of these rituals. They said, they're concocted, why should we follow them? But does that mean they're without rituals? No, they have their own rituals. Again, where did they come from? They made them up. Somebody made them up. And then people follow them, and after a while it becomes that if you don't follow the rituals, you're not a proper follower of the religion. And then you have, of course, so many sub-sects, which each develop their own set of rituals, their own particular way of dressing. And you find this in every religious system. And they'll often dress according to, like the ultra-Orthodox Jews. The men wear these long black coats and they wear these particular hats. You know why? Because that was the fashion of everybody in Poland at a particular time. That was how all the Poles dressed, and there was a large Jewish community in Poland until Hitler wiped them all out. But he particularly went to Poland. So they had this their way of dressing. And that became now, if you see any ultra-Orthodox or Hasidic Jew, that's how they're dressing. It's not in the Bible. It's not something in the Bible. It actually came from a secular way of dressing, secular way of behaving. And so these things get changed over, and people get very attached to these rituals. And it seems that people are not really able to live without rituals. Because if they don't have anything that's bona fide, they make them up. And even modern secular society has various rituals. And each society has its own particular rituals. Right? Yes? There must be some need. There must be something very intrinsic that if we don't have them, we create them. And yet then there's a rebellion that happens also, like the Protestants rebelled against the Catholics. So there's a general sense of rebellion that, well, why do we have to follow all these rituals? Is religion and spirituality about rituals anyway? Why can't we just do whatever we feel like? So, of course, these are the two sides of Niyamagraha. One side of Niyamagraha is you're just following rituals just because you're following them. And the other side of Niyamagraha is you say, let me just throw out all the rituals. Let me just do whatever I want. And what happens when you throw out all the rituals and do whatever you want? You eventually create your own rituals. You eventually make something up as your new rituals. And it's interesting here that both the demons and the demigods are following the rituals. Isn't that interesting? You know, in the 16th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, there Srila Prabhupada explains that the difference between the demons and the demigods are whether or not they follow the Shastra. That's the demarcation line. But I was just reading, I think it's in the second canto. No, it's in Krishna book, where Vasudeva is arguing with Kamsa. And there Prabhupada says the difference between the devotees and the demons is that the devotees will take good advice and the demons won't. Well, you can kind of judge yourself. How do you react to good advice, you know? And to see how demoniac or devotional you are. But of course, although the demons follow the rituals of the, at least these demons in the Bhagavatam, follow the rituals of the Shastra, their purpose is really to overpower the head of the universe. They have a different purpose. So when I was 17, I worked as a baker in a Marriott hotel. I used to bake all of the cakes and pies and bread for the hotel. It was my summer job. when I learned that working in the world was not what I wanted to do with my life. You work so hard for money, and then, you know, oh, I got some money, and then you were so tired you couldn't enjoy it because you were working so hard. But anyway, one of the things I noticed in the hotel restaurant was that most of the people there, did not include me by any means, but most of the people there were aspiring to take over the hotel. You know, they were just washing dishes, or they were just dipping onion rings or something like that. And they were reading books about hotel management and taking courses in hotel management. So why were they behaving? They were behaving so they could work their way up and knock the guy on top off and take his place. That was their motive. It was really interesting. Almost everybody there. Few exceptions. I mean, I was just working there for the summer. I had no desire to run a hotel. But almost everybody there, that was their career. So that's the demon's idea. The demon's idea is I will follow the rules of Shastra with the purpose of becoming God. That's what I want to do. And then I'm going to make the rules. And of course, the epitome of this was Hiranyakashipu, where he followed the rules so he could become the chief person in the universe and make his own rules. And he did make his own rules. He forced all of the trees to bear fruit and flowers all year, out of season. Does that sound familiar? Like something that we find in the present time? He changed the order and the structure of the universe, put everything into chaos. So that's the view of the demons. Whereas the demigods are following the rules out of respect to Krishna, that these are his rules. So we find in our modern society, I would say that in general, people are not so much into religious rituals. Would you agree? It's kind of out of fashion to be into religious rituals. Decreasing. You know, we do have that the people who are into the religious rituals are increasing in their, how would you say, volume level. So the people who are fighting, you know, let's keep all of the rituals of the religion, they're very vocal in the modern world. But people in general are becoming secular. Most governments in the world are secular. The media, the education programs are primarily secular. Even in places where legally they have to be religious, like in the UK, they secularize the religious component of the schools. So the UK government demands that there's, what do they call it? Communal worship, that's not what they call it. Anyway, some sort of group worship every morning. What's it called? Anyway. Starts with a C, I can't remember. And it's supposed to be a time primarily devoted to Christian, Anglican Christian prayers and worship. But because the UK is such a multi-religious, multi-ethnic society, and they don't want to offend anybody, and because although officially they have a religion of the Anglican Church, really the government is secular. So their group worship every morning is basically secular. It's just about values. Which is, by the way, Rajagun. So they're just talking about, you know, be honest, be good, be a good citizen. And, you know, they might sprinkle a little God or Jesus in here and there, but it's not really that emphasis. So we see that Srila Prabhupada, you know, he understood that if you're preaching to the world, how many rules are you going to introduce? I mean, Paul's idea was a little bit correct, that if you're going to preach to non-Jews, to people who weren't brought up as Jews, and you start telling them you have to do all the rituals of the Jews, they're not even going to listen to you. So when Srila Prabhupada traveled around the world, he did not say to us, okay, you've got to sit on kusha grass, you know, and you've got to wear particular ornaments. Actually, in the fourth canto, Srila Prabhupada says that we can no longer find... We can no longer find the proper jewels to wear. Just like Dhruva Maharaj, before he got on the Vaikuntha airplane, he decorated himself with valuable jewels. And it wasn't that long ago, a few hundred years ago even,
that everyone understood that different stones had different healing potencies and had different effects on your consciousness. And Prabhupada in that purport said, we can't find these jewels today, so we just wear tilak. That's our ornaments. That's how we have the word bhushana. Bhushana here means ornaments. So our primary ornament is tilak. And you see that Srila Prabhupada made our rules and regulations very, very simple. He made them simple and he standardized them. It's another interesting thing that he did. If you look at the Gaudiya Vaishnava history and you look at our literature, you see that, say, Rupa Goswami, he gives 64 rules and regulations of bhakti. First he gives 10 positive ones and 10 negative ones, and then he gives another 44 ones that are primarily positive. And these, of course, can be categorized into the 9 processes of hearing, chanting, remembering, etc. And then he also gives the 3 most important. Anybody know the 3 most important of the 64 angas? Nope. Yes, to take shelter of a spiritual master, to follow his instructions, and to take initiation from him. So that's the 3 most important and the 5 most potent. Holy name. Holy name, chanting, hearing. Bhagavatam. Sacred place. Deity worship, eh? Association with devotees. So, but you don't find that Rupa Goswami is giving very... In fact, he says, I'm just giving principles, I'm not giving details. You'll have to get details from your guru, is what he says. Now then, Gopal Bhatta Goswami and Sanatana Goswami wrote the Hari Bhakti Vilas, which has a lot of details. But Srila Bhaktisiddhanta and Srila Prabhupada say that you have to rely more on Sanatana Goswami's commentary in the Hari Bhakti Vilas than the verses themselves. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Bhaktyaloka, the Niyamagraha section, says the Hari Bhakti Vilas is really just for householders and primarily wealthy householders. He says the end of the Hari Bhakti Vilas, it says the rules here do not apply to renunciates. And a lot of the details of the Hari Bhakti Vilas are far beyond. I mean, I don't know very many people in the Hare Krishna movement who follow all the rules of the Hari Bhakti Vilas. So what Srila Prabhupada did, oh, let me go back a little bit. So we find that traditional devotees, what they would do is they would each apply these angas of bhakti according to their particular situation, under the guidance of their particular guru. So you had general principles, and then the specific practice was very individualized, although there were some general rules given in the Hari Bhakti Vilas. The Hari Bhakti Vilas and the Nectar of Devotion, you can see from Chaitanya Charitamrita that they come from the instructions of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to Rupa and Sanatana. And of course, many of the rules were also standard rules of deity worship, say from the Narada Pancharatra, that are followed by the other sampradayas. But still, they were done differently in different places. And Srila Prabhupada, to have a worldwide movement combining people from all different cultures, just like in this one room, there's people from all different cultural and ethnic backgrounds. You don't find that everywhere in ISKCON, by the way. Some places you go in ISKCON, everybody is from the same national and ethnic and cultural background. In some places you go, it's a wild mix. You know, there's 200 people in the temple room, and each of them is from a different background. It's very international, so depending on where you go. But everywhere you go, I was just thinking about that actually this morning, it's basically the same. I mean, there's some difference in culture, definitely. But it's basically the same. You know, we have our same basic rituals, and we have some sort of standardized basic culture, although there is different flavors in different places, for sure. Yeah, it's not exactly the same, especially if you go to some place where everybody is from the local culture. Then you find you get some little different flavors. And that's especially true if your local culture was originally a Vaishnava or a Hindu culture. You'll find that. So like I was recently in Manipur, and I think it's actually quite lovely, that they haven't just taken on our worldwide ISKCON culture, because they're all coming in the line from Narottama Das Thakur, which is, of course, bona fide Gaudiya Vaishnava culture, and they've kept that. Not entirely, but they've kept that. So they have a different kind of cartels than we do, and different sort of string on them. They have a big, fat string. You can't wrap it around your fingers, and they play them differently. and they have a different kirtan procedure. They follow Narottamadas Thakur's kirtan procedure. Actually, they have many lady kirtan parties that go from temple to temple. Usually they'll have men playing the mridanga, but the rest of the kirtan party is made up of women. And they'll all dress the same when they go to do kirtan. In the beginning of the kirtan, like here they talk about the beginning, they bathe and they offer this and they wear this. So beginning of the kirtan, the head of the temple gives each of the members of the party cloth and some little monetary donation before they start the kirtan. And at the most famous temple there, during the kirtan, there's one person blowing two conch shells simultaneously. It is really, it's amazing. Just to look at it is amazing. And he's blowing them throughout the kirtan as a musical instrument. He's not just blowing them at the beginning and the end of the kirtan. It's incredible. You know, they have their own tunes, and they also have their own dress. Like here's talking about, Prabhupada's talking about the dress. So there in Manipur, the women, whenever they're going to a temple or religious function, they wear saffron silk. So especially early in the morning, you see all the women who are going to temple, they're all wearing, they wear a saffron silk lungi. And if they're married, they wear a white chadar, and if their husbands are dead or they're renounced, then they wear a saffron top piece also. So they have their own particular culture. Their tilak is a little different. It's much more narrow, you know, and it's really, really nice. You can see the way they dress the deities also is in their own style. And when we were there, we saw a wonderful drama of Virachandra Maharaj. I think his name was Bhagyachandra, a famous Vaishnava king in Manipur. And it was all done in their traditional Manipur costumes and traditional Manipur dancing, and it was just wonderful and amazing. But you see this even if we have temples in places that are not traditional Vaishnava culture, that certain aspects of the surrounding culture, especially if all the devotees or most of the devotees are from that culture, will influence the temple, will influence the food, will influence even just the dealings between the devotees. It may influence the tune that they use, sometimes influences some of the instruments. Right, and you have some sort of a mixing. At the same time, you have a basic ISKCON culture that's everywhere in the world. Everywhere. You know, you can go to a village in China, and you can go to a city in America, and you can go to Russia, and you can go to South India, and it's basically the same. So how did Prabhupada do that? He took what were the most essential features of the culture, what were the most essential rituals. He didn't say, okay, no rituals, like Paul did, and then people end up having to concoct them. He took genuine, but he took only the minimum. No, he did say at one point that he wanted us to have more of the authentic rituals for deity worship. You know, when I joined, the deity worship was simple is an understatement. So it was extremely, extremely simple in terms of the ritual and the mantra. Of course, that's what we have most of our rituals, is in deity worship and in yajnas, and now the devotees becoming expert in samskaras. So Srila Prabhupada wanted us to do that. And the people who are very, very attracted to rituals tend to get into that area of our Krishna consciousness movement. So why do we do all these rituals? Why do we have them at all? And why do they seem to exist even for people who try to throw them out? You know, people who say, well, we don't want these rituals, they come back. So it's very interesting, because even on the platform of spontaneous devotion, there still seems to be order and procedures. They're different, but there's still some order and procedures. Although it's explained that spontaneous devotion is not subject to the ordinary regulations of Shastra. That's one of its features. It's one of its identifying features. And it's what we're all aspiring to, right? I hope, yes. Maybe some of us just want to go to Vaikuntha. The idea is that in Vaidhi Bhakti, you're governed by the rituals and the regulations of the scriptures, and Raghunuga Bhakti, you're governed by love. But even in Raghunuga Bhakti, there's procedures. There's procedures for Raghunuga Sadhana. So in Jayavidharma, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that Swarup Damodar Goswami, the secretary to Mahaprabhu, instructed two systems of Raghunuga Sadhana, one to Vakeshwar Pandit, one to Raghunath Das Goswami. And it's a system, it's a sadhana. and Rupa Goswami in the Nectar Devotion, and also Nectar of Instruction, particularly in text 8, gives what is the procedure. So there's a certain procedure. You can't even just say, well, I have spontaneous love for Krishna, I'm just going to do whatever I feel like it. You know, there are some tastes, like we have here, they dress themselves with new garments according to their own choice. So we have that one in the Sanskrit. Yata upayosham, according to one's taste. So there's individuality, but still Prabhupada said they couldn't wear anything sewn with a needle. So they had to pick clothes that were new, and they had to pick clothes that were not sewn with a needle, but within that restriction, they could dress according to their taste. So some restrictions for both. What are they for? And why do we like them? Well, for one thing, Krishna seems to be an orderly person. We're part of Krishna. Doesn't he seem to be orderly? You know, there's seasons that come in a particular order. You can predict when the stars and planets will be in a particular place. You can predict when the sun's going to rise 100 years from now to the second. And you can count on it. He seems to like a particular order. There's repeating orders of number, what they call Fibonacci numbers? Fibonacci. Fibonacci numbers. That repeat in nature. And there's another set of numbers, too, I forget what they're called. So there's certain repeating patterns in nature, or the Lord is sometimes called the Lord of Threes in the Bhagavatam. You know, and we also have certain numbers, like, you know, 108. Probably shouldn't say this, but you know, if you're at any temple and you want to try the password for the devotee, just try 108 or 1008, you know, or the combination locks on the temple door. You know. What's your combination? 1008. But these numbers repeat, and 16 also, right? So we have 8, 16, 108, 3, certain numbers. So he's an orderly person. And there's orders and patterns, even in the DNA, right, as this order and pattern. And because Krishna's like that, and we're part of Krishna, we like order. We like patterns. We like symmetry and harmony and regulation and regularity. One of the best things you can do for little children is to have them have some sort of regularity in their life, makes their mind peaceful. Not, you know, when you have children who don't know when they're going to sleep and when they're going to eat, then they're always hungry and tired, basically. But at the same time, Krishna's not only orderly. He also likes surprises, and he also likes spontaneity. You know, you can depend on the earth, but sometimes there's earthquakes. Sometimes in the middle of the winter, it's a warm day. Sometimes in the middle of the summer, it's a cold day. There's surprise storms, right? All the planets are going in order, but there's comets and meteorites. And some of them are orderly and some of them are random. Right? So there's some randomness too. And we like that as well. In fact, I was reading one article that the real key to sustained love in a marriage is some element of surprise, of continuing surprise. That if you get to the point that you think, oh, I know this person backwards and forwards and inside out, then the intensity of the affection you feel for them diminishes. And I was thinking how in the spiritual world, there's always some element of surprise, always an element of newness, navyovanam cha. Radharani's always cooking something different. Krishna doesn't know, what is she going to cook today? You know, although in one sense, she's making the same things over and over again, there's variety. So Krishna has his eightfold pastimes that are repeating every day, but every time there's some variety. So there's this combination of order and variety. And if you study personality styles, each of us has a preference. So each of us has a preference either for order or for variety. If you look at personality styles, some people are more sequential and some people are more random. So each of us have some sequential and some random. There's nobody who's only random or only sequential, but some of us really like order, and we don't like too many surprises. And others of us thrive on surprises and change and variety, but we like a little bit of order with some things, right? And that's a useful thing to know. The person who manages your money, they should be someone who likes order. They shouldn't be someone who likes surprises and change. And the person who travels from country to country and doesn't know where they're going to end up the next day, they should be somebody who likes change. As one of our godbrothers just left his body in the UK, Jivapati, so he was a real order person. You know, I think he only left the manor like 2 times in 35 years or something like that, and he just followed the same schedule every single day. And then you find other people who are, you know, they're doing something totally different every day. They're in a different part of the world, and when they wake up in the morning, they have to say, "Where am I?" Right? So we have different kinds of people, but we both have a desire. We all have a desire for both of these things. So religious rituals should never be taken as ends in and of themselves. We're not interested in the rituals for the sake of the rituals. We're not interested in becoming expert in the rituals for the sake of becoming expert in the rituals. The rituals are there because they make Krishna happy. Just like we have certain order in our life that makes us happy. We have a certain way we like things to be done. Yes? Even highly random people, they still have ways they like things to be done. And Krishna has this, he's a person. Some of the rituals you can understand and say, okay, well, there's this scientific basis behind it. It was interesting, when I studied Ayurveda, I started seeing how pretty much all of the rules and rituals that Srila Prabhupada gave us had a scientific basis. I mean, why are they doing things like facing east and sitting on kusha grass? And all these things actually affect your consciousness. It's not just some random, not just somebody said, well, let's just have this ritual. So the rituals in the Shastra are given by Krishna because they're actually good for us and good for him. They please us and they please him. They bring happiness. They bring happiness. They bring health. They bring peace. But some of the rituals you could say are just there because he's a person. And he has his own likes and dislikes. Certain things he likes more than others. Now, in one sense, there's no difference between that, because anything that Krishna likes is by definition something that brings health and happiness and peace to people. But perhaps some things you can only explain that's what he likes. Just like some of us like broccoli and some of us don't. So say, why do you like it? Why do you not like it? When George W. Bush became president, he said, no broccoli will be served in the White House. Mm-hmm. And of course, the broccoli growers of America were all very upset. And he said, I've never liked broccoli, and now that I'm president of the United States, I'm not going to eat it anymore. So Krishna has things that he likes. You know? I mean, Krishna could eat meat as a universal form. He eats everything. Right? In the universal form, he's smashing the soldiers between his teeth. Yes? So Krishna could eat. He doesn't like it. He doesn't like it. And of course, because Krishna doesn't like it, we can also say that if you eat meat, it makes you sick. If you eat meat, it disturbs, you know, destroys your higher feelings of empathy. It damages the ecology. But why does it do all those things? Because Krishna doesn't like it. So we're following the rituals to please Krishna because he likes them. But Krishna also may sometimes like us to do something beyond the rituals. He doesn't want us to be attached to the rituals in and of themselves as some kind of pride. I'm a very good ritual follower. That's another upadhi. You know, I should be a devotee of Krishna, lover of Krishna, servant of Krishna. And generally, Krishna wants us to follow the rules because they're his rules, and they're his rules because he likes them, and he likes them because they're good for us, and they're good for us because he likes them. However you want to look at it. But sometimes, he may like something else. You know, just like Yudhisthira, he told Yudhisthira to tell a lie. And generally, Krishna doesn't like lying. Of course, in Goloka Vrindavan, it's a little different. He lies to his mother all the time. I didn't eat clay. I didn't take the butter. You know. Why is there butter all over your mouth? The other boys put it there, you know. Krishna's always telling stories to his mother, but she finds it very charming. And he lies to the gopis too. They also find it charming. Generally, sometimes they get mad at him. But that's also part of their charming exchange. Yeah. She says, I'm so sorry I'm late. You know, I was held up with a festival. Well, you weren't held up with a festival. We know where you were, what you were doing. But generally, Krishna likes truth. Of course, because he's the absolute truth. Even if Krishna lies, it's absolutely true. That's another discussion. But in this case, he wanted Yudhisthira, because Yudhisthira, you saw Yudhisthira was more attached to his reputation as a truthful man than to love. You know, Mahaprabhu was asked, so why are you chanting the names of God? The wife doesn't say her husband's name. I mean, in modern society, women do say their husband's name. Alan or Joe or whatever. But in traditional society, you didn't say the name of your superior. Actually, there's one friend of mine who lives in Vrindavan. She grew up in Australia, but she married a local Vrindavan man. And she won't even say my husband. I said, I can understand you don't want to say his name, but why don't you want to say my husband? She said, no, I can't even say my husband. So she'll say my baby's father. And I said, you know, in the world today, if you say my baby's father, it means you're divorced. Or you were never married, you know. I mean, this is something funny. Say my husband. Anyway, she won't do it. So the idea is you don't say the name of your superior. It's disrespectful. You don't call them by name, you know. Hey, Joe. The wife calls her husband Swami or Prabhu, right, or not. Actually, Prabhupada said the husband shouldn't even generally call his wife by name. He should call her Devi. He should call her goddess. That's another thing. I haven't met very many ISKCON men who do that. I know a couple who do. I know one who calls his wife Priya. But anyway, so this scholar was asking Lord Chaitanya, you know, why are you, Krishna is the husband of everyone, why are you saying his name? He said, he told him, he said, you're not following religious principles, you're not following the rules. And Mahaprabhu said, you don't understand the rules. He said, the real rule of the wife is to follow the instructions of her husband. And Krishna's instruction is chant my name. So there may be a rule, don't say your husband's name, but if your husband says, say my name, you can't say, no, I can't do that. Because there's a rule that I don't say your name. And the essential rule is respect. So Krishna wants to see both. Krishna wants to see that we follow the rules, and Krishna wants to see that the reason we're following the rules is because we love him, and that our love for him takes precedence over rule following. So Krishna wants to see that too. Why are we following the rules? And Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Bhaktiloka, speaking about Niyamagraha, which is a wonderful section, and it doesn't take won't take you longer than 10 minutes to read it, 10-15 minutes to read it, and I highly recommend it to everybody. In Bhaktiloka, Bhaktivinoda Thakur discusses the second and third verse of the Upadeshamrita, the do's and the do nots that Rupa Goswami gives there. You know, so Rupa Goswami gives the 64 do's and do nots in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and in his Upadesha Amrita, he just gives 6 do's and 6 do nots, although one of his do's is also a do not, really. He says in the do nots to don't associate with non-devotees, and in the do's he says don't associate with non-devotees. So he really is giving you 7 and 5, although he stuck one of the do nots and the do's. But anyway, Bhaktivinoda Thakur went through these, and he explains each of them, and he explains this is how you do it if you're a householder, and this is how you do it if you're a renunciate. It was quite useful. And the section on Niyamagraha I found particularly enlightening. And there he talks about, and I'm not going to be able to go over all of it now by any means, but the main principle he says there is that the rules change as you advance. And what you need to do is you need to know where you are. You need to know what the rules and regulations, the positives, the what to do and what not to do are for where you are. And you need to use those to advance to the next step, at which point what you should do and what you should not do changes. And he says if you're attached to the rules of the previous step, they'll act as chains around your feet, you won't be able to progress. Prabhupada talks about that statement in regard to being attached to a particular sectarian religion. that if you're attached to a particular sectarian religion and you don't try to love God, that that attachment will act as chains around your feet, which is Bhakti Vinod Thakur is saying. And there in the Niyamagrahat section, he talks about the yoga ladder. He talks about how you follow Varnashram so you can come to Karma Yoga, so you can come to Gyan Yoga. He talks about the rules for karma, the rules for Gyan, and the rules for Bhakti. And he says, ultimately, for the pure devotee, for the liberated soul, there's only one rule and one regulation. The one rule is have prema, have love, and the one regulation is don't envy. And within that, you can do whatever you want. Just like the demigods and the demons here, as long as they had new clothing that wasn't sewn with a needle, they could wear whatever they wanted. So they had some choice within a very narrow range. But the freer you are, the more trustworthy you are, the purer you are, the wider the scope of what your taste is. You can do more of what you want. So the lower you are on the staircase, the tighter the rules are, because you can't be trusted. And as you go up, they get more and more and more open. They become more principles. You really move to principles instead of details. And much more, here's the basic framework, and within this framework, you can act according to your taste. Why? Because everything you're going to desire will be good. So our view about the rules and regulations is to remember that all the rules and regulations are really meant to help us always remember Krishna and never forget him with love. That's really the purpose. The purpose of the rules is never just to be a good rule follower. You know, oh, okay, I chanted my 16 rounds, I got them done. I did the right number of circles of incense waving. I said the right mantra. You know, I know how to time my dhoti in this particular way. And therefore, I am a good devotee. That may be useful in the very beginning, but gradually one should see that the reason we're following these rules is for a relationship with Krishna. And we focus more on the relationship with Krishna, which means our following the rules becomes from a different mood. And the kind of rules we follow also change. The kind of strictures. We should also be careful when looking at other devotees. So we have to be careful not to judge the very advanced devotees by the lesser standard. Like you can see photographs of Srila Prabhupada, who is a sannyasi, wearing kurtas. Although Prabhupada says here, a sannyasi doesn't wear clothing sewn with a needle, but Prabhupada wore kurtas, he wore coats. You know, he didn't just wear lots and lots of chudders when he was in cold climates. He did wear clothing sewn with a needle. And there's even some photographs you can see Srila Prabhupada worshipping the deity with a kurta. Although, as Prabhupada says here, either sannyasi or somebody performing a ritualistic ceremony should not wear sewn clothing. But Srila Prabhupada's functioning on a different platform. And not only should we be careful about criticizing the higher devotees who may not follow all of the rules of the lower standard. That doesn't mean higher devotees are engaged in illicit sex, intoxication, meat eating, gambling. That's not what we mean. Although Garuda eats meat, and he's a pure devotee. You can't say, well, Garuda is condemned because he eats meat. He eats snakes. He's not functioning according to our conceptions, but I don't know of any other exception. So the great devotees, they don't engage in activities like that, but they may not be so, like there was this one devotee during Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasvati's time, what was his name, Vamsi Das Babaji, and his servant wrote that over the course of 4 months, he never saw Vamsi bathe or pass stool and urine. For 4 months. So if you don't have to pass stool and urine for 4 months, then you don't have to bathe either. And he would dress, he had gorni tidings, and he would dress them sometimes rather oddly. But he was also talking to the deities. And sometimes he'd yell at his deities. Not that we should yell at the deities, not that we should go to Nitya Mayapur Chandra and start yelling at them. What are you doing? But persons on that platform, they can do, like Mother Yasoda's yelling at Krishna. Sometimes Radharani yells at Krishna also. By the way, you never find Krishna yelling at Radharani. But Radharani does yell at Krishna. So we can't judge persons on that platform by our particular regulations. We can't say, wait a minute, you're not following exactly the deity worship procedures, or Sanatana Goswami offering his deity just like these bread balls, you know, without salt. So we should be careful. Obviously, we don't want to be foolish and accept that everybody is a great saint and therefore they can do anything and let all sorts of irreligion and improper behavior into our Hare Krishna movement. At the same time, we should recognize that there are persons in our movement who are an advanced platform, and their worship is a little different. And the other thing we should be careful of is not trying to pull people up faster than they can go. This is the offense of preaching the glories of the holy name to the faithless. And Prabhupada says in the instruction about the austerities of speech that one should only speak bitter truths to one's students. Now that can be permanent students or temporary students, like you're all temporarily my students. So as soon as we stop the class, you're not my students anymore. I can't walk up to one of you outside and give you an instruction. As long as you're sitting here, you're de facto giving me permission to say heavy truths. I mean, and you could always get up and leave if you want. But we have kind of a contract. You follow? So you can say strong things if you have a contract that people are willing to hear, and you have to see what their level is. Like I've seen some of our devotees in our Hare Krishna movement, if you try to convince them that Varnashram isn't the be-all and end-all of existence, and if you succeed at convincing them, they'll just engage in sinful activities. So you may see that this person's functioning on a lower platform, but you may actually have to encourage them on that platform, and you encourage them to come up gradually. So don't try to pull down people who are on a higher platform than us. And although we should try to help people on a lower platform, we should do it according to what they're able to take and what they're able to do, and understand that different people, some people are going to have to follow things that are lower than what we're following, and some people are going to be following things that are higher than what we're following. So to see that for ourselves, and to also see that for others. So thankfully, Srila Prabhupada has not required that us in the Hare Krishna movement have to bathe in the Ganga or Yamuna or the sea before all of our ritualistic functions. We would have a hard time having centers far from any of those places. Right? We wouldn't be able to have a center in Johannesburg because it's not by the Ganga, Yamuna, or the ocean. And even here, all of us would have to be trooping down to the ocean, right, every morning. And nor did Prabhupada require that all of us wear only unsewn clothing. No, he never gave that kind of requirement. Wait, the women actually used to wear, the Brahmin women, they would wear just like, as they wouldn't wear a sewn shirt, they would wear just a piece of cloth as a shirt. And even today, some in South India particularly, some of the Brahmin ladies, when they're doing archana, they don't wear any sewn clothing. But Prabhupada didn't require that. Right? Even for the sannyasis. It's funny, even though he says here it's especially significant and they should not dress themselves. It wasn't something that Prabhupada absolutely required in our Krishna consciousness movement. I mean, you can go to some temples in India where they will not allow you to enter the temple with sewn clothing. At least the men. They won't allow you to enter the temple. And I was just in one of our ISKCON temples in South India where they were doing Snani Yatra for Jagannath. And they had extra cloth there for the men. And they wouldn't allow them to do the snan in pants or with any kind of a shirt on and that sort of thing. But Srila Prabhupada gave us, I mean, for most of us, it's already enough what Srila Prabhupada gave. You know, for most people to go their whole life with rising early, taking a bath, going to Mangalarchi, chanting 16 rounds, then chanting 3 Gayatris, you know, following the 4 regular principles, worshiping the deity, offering their food, eating only food cooked by devotees, reading the scriptures every day. You know, we have to admit, that for the majority of people who take to Krishna consciousness, that's a lot. You know, that's a lot. And if you add a whole bunch of other things, well, you can only wear this kind of thing and this kind of thing, and you have to wear certain ornaments, and you have to have kusha grass. We wouldn't be able to spread Krishna consciousness. So, interesting here, both the demigods and the demons, but for different purposes, with different mentalities. And they knew all the rituals, and they knew how to do things so that they could be happy in the world. So, of course, our goal is not just to be happy in the world, but our goal is to attain eternal happiness. And we're given the formula by which to do that. So let us do that with actual attention to the essence of what we're doing. And being attached to the essence of what we're doing, we will neither do things ritualistically nor abandon them whimsically. So, sorry I went a little late. Do we have any time for questions, or am I like way over? Breakfast is not ready yet. That's the actual end, right? You guys are really late. Breakfast. Yes?
I like the point we made about you shouldn't pull up people too fast and as it does. I was thinking about how international society of Krishna consciousness, where non-sectarian and it's all-inclusive, which is per definition spiritual, should be. So then usually when we see people that really struggle to give up some habits like intoxication in a woman, then generally they are considered like outside, which is not appropriate because they're just on a lower, they're just struggling at that step, and at the previous life we probably were there, and how we should convince people to follow for eggs, we should just convince them to chant, and then the chant.
Well, it depends on the person.
Encourage.
It depends on the person. How you encourage each person is very, very individual.
Yeah.
So some people, you can encourage them to follow the four regs from day one, and they can do it from day one, and they'll do it the rest of their life.
Mm.
So you don't want to have a policy where you don't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, when I first visited a temple, I was 14, and I asked one of the ladies there, what do I have to do to join? And unfortunately, she didn't tell me about the four regular principles. I wish she had.
Mm.
She didn't. She looked at me, and I was there with some boy from school who I barely knew. And she must have assumed that we were like together, and maybe she figured I wasn't 14. I mean, she didn't ask me how old I was. You know, especially girls, it's harder to pin the age. Maybe she thought I was like 18 or 20, I don't know. But she said, there's no room in the ashram, you'll have to get your own flat. That was all she said. You know, I said, I want to join. How do I join the movement? She didn't say, here's some beads and you chant and follow the principles and read the book. She just said, we don't have any room in the ashram. You need to get your own apartment. And so I didn't go back to that temple. And I didn't go to any temple for the next 3 years. And the people asked me, what do you believe in? I'd say, I believe in Hare Krishna. They said, do you follow it? I said, no, I can't. I mean, it was some kind of bad karma of mine that I wasted those 3 years, Hare Krishna. Because that happened to me, I do try to at least mention the four regulative principles whenever I preach to new people. At least list them, so at least they know. I didn't even know. Isn't that bizarre? Yeah, nobody told me. But you want to deal with each person differently, and not make assumptions about what's easy for different people. I mean, I know one Indian-bodied man who it took his wife. Became a devotee faster than he did. Sometimes we assume with Indians that they're just going to naturally be able to take to Krishna consciousness, but they have, you know, indeed, people with Indian background have different sorts of, and sometimes the same, struggles. And this man took 2 years to become a vegetarian. Although his wife was already chanting, and he's Indian. When I was at the Gita Nagari farm, we went there from New York City. So I noticed that when we were in New York City, if you talked about the four principles, people would say, vegetarianism, no problem. Go gambling, no problem. Intoxication, illicit sex, forget it. And then when we went out in the country, and we were on a farm, and one day a year, we'd invite all the local farmers to come. And their response was exactly the opposite. They would say, you know, no intoxication, no problem. No illicit sex, no problem. No gambling, no problem. No meat eating? Because they were all raising animals for slaughter. It was their livelihood. So what was, you know, done in an hour by somebody in the city, okay, I'll become a vegetarian, sure. The people in the country who were raising cows and pigs and chickens, for them that was a big hurdle. So what is a block for different people is going to be very different. And what our attachments are is going to be very, very different. Some of it's yet past life. Some of it's our particular culture that we're from. I stayed with one family in Mumbai where
both the husband and wife come from the Madhva Sampradaya, and they both come from Brahmin families in the Madhva Sampradaya. And so the husband had a Shalagram Shila that had been in his family for generations and generations and generations. And when I stayed there, he puts on a purple silk dhoti to worship his Shila. And he looked at me and he said, when I'm in the temple, I follow the Gaudiya standards. When I'm home, I follow my own traditional standards. And just even the particular rituals that he did at home were Madhva standards. There's one temple, please don't ask me where it is, that has a rule that for anyone to get initiated, that during their home worship, they can't wear a lungi, they have to wear a dhoti. And so there's one devotee there who comes from Kerala. This is, the temple's not in India, the temple's in a Western, a European country. So he's from Kerala, where everybody wears lungis, nobody wears dhotis. Everybody wears a lungi. And he said that before they would recommend him for initiation, he had to, you know, vow that in his home, when he did his own worship to little pictures on his altar, that he was wearing a dhoti, not a lungi. It's like, my God. So Bhaktivinoda Thakura says, one will fall down if one goes too fast or too slow. So that for ourselves, we shouldn't try to go faster than we're actually able to go. We shouldn't try to go slower than we're able to go. We should be careful with other people that we preach to them appropriately. Yes?
I was just wondering, like, especially if we preach to new people, or they start taking Krishna consciousness, and then obviously there's some habits that are not favorable to devotional service, and then I also just usually take the approach of just telling them, it's okay, just chant, and then you become purified, and then you gradually let go. But I'm just wondering about how that works. If you start chanting, is it just like, is it the chanting itself that purifies you, or does the chanting just like give you the strength by which you can
both? Basically, by chanting and offering your food and all of the things we do in bhakti, we could say particularly chanting and hearing, but everything, and everything we do in bhakti has that potency, that Krishna enlightens you from within your heart and you see things as they are, your vision is clear, and you see, Prabhupada says, the naked form of material desires. And when you see your material attachments for what they are, it's very easy to give them up. Maya means that which is not. So when one sees a material attachment as something that will bring me happiness and something that will bring me shelter, and then you're attached to it because you think it will give you those things. And when you see it for what it is, which is something quite different from that, then you naturally give up your attachment to it. It is just very natural. You know, if you... It's just like if you're very attached to another person and you think that they're your good friend and you rely on them, and then you find out that actually they've been cheating you for years. You find out they've been bad-mouthing you to your friends, lying about you to your friends, twisting what you say to make you look bad to your friends, ruining your reputation in the community, stealing your money, and so forth. Then, generally, not always, but generally, you can very easily give up your attachment to that person, because not always. Sometimes people's attachment is so strong that even when they see them like that, they can't do that. But when we see Maya for what it is, we see that Maya is, you know, Durga Devi riding on a tiger with a trident. We're thinking, oh, my mommy, my shelter. Kamashrita, the demons have Kamashrita. They take shelter of lust, or Ahankar Ashrita, take shelter of false ego. But when you see lust and false ego for what it is, like, I don't want to be under that shelter. It's not a shelter. So, and that happens by bhakti. So some persons, again, depending on their past life, depending on so many things, they may be able to see that very quickly, and other people are going to take a long time to see that.
It's necessarily going to be a struggle still, even when you see it where it is. And it's going to be, you're going to have to...
Giving up things is not a struggle. Getting the courage to give them up is a struggle. The act of giving something up is not a struggle at all. The decision to give up the thing is a big struggle. The process of becoming convinced to give things up is more or less. Some things are easy. Again, it depends on the individual. Like I was saying, for some people, becoming a vegetarian is a matter of, you should be a vegetarian, okay. And that's the end of it. And they never eat meat, fish, and eggs again for the rest of their life. And other people, it's this long, years and years struggle. And for the person where it was nothing, they're like, why are you struggling with this? But for the person where that was nothing, maybe something else is a struggle, you know, frankly. Like some people, their relationship with the other devotees is wonderful from day one, and other people, you have to say, they're hanging around 30, 40 years and they still can't be respectful to anybody. Right? And the person who's respectful from day one, again, they may say, well, what's your problem? But in general, you see that people are in different levels. So I wrote an article that got published on dandavatsaniskan.com called What is ISKCON and What is a Member of ISKCON? And I was seeing how Srila Prabhupada defined the function of ISKCON on several different levels. So he defined ISKCON in terms of that it's the lila of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that can be understood that there are some people in ISKCON, they're functioning, that they're participating in Lord Chaitanya's lila. They're participating in Krishna's lila. And that's how they feel about the preaching, and that's how they feel about their own spiritual practices. You know, when they're dancing in front of Nityamaya Purchandra, they feel like they're dancing in front of Nityamaya Purchandra in their lila. And then Prabhupada also would say that ISKCON is for personal purification. ISKCON, he would say, it was for personal liberation, personal salvation. So that's sattva-gun, that's not transcendental. And there are people in ISKCON, they're here on that level. They're in ISKCON because ISKCON facilitates, ISKCON as a platform for their personal liberation. That they feel that they can attain the purification that they want, or even they're thinking about Krishna prema, but they're really thinking about it in terms of liberation. They're feeling, you know, I can't do it alone, better I do. I have the society to help me. And then Prabhupada also said ISKCON is for establishing Varnashram. Well, that's Rajagun. That's just ordinary material piety. That's material piety to be happy in the world. Of course, Varnashram is the basis for the yoga ladder, and there are people here for that. There are people, their whole focus in ISKCON is we should establish Varnashram and we should be pious and we should be ethical and we should. And then there's even a lower level that ISKCON actually exists on, although Prabhupada said not to be an ISKCON in that way. And that is on the level of, you know, money and politics and power. And that also exists. There are people in ISKCON because they can get a place to stay or they can get a visa to a more prosperous country or they can get some power over others or something like that. So there are also people on that level. And you see people functioning differently. Yes?
How do we bring people down?
How can you bring people down?
How do we, yeah.
Okay. When I say bringing people down, I mean more that in ourselves we're criticizing them because they're higher than us and we want to at least internally bring them down. We don't understand they're operating according to a higher principle. You can see why that would be difficult, because if someone's on a higher platform from us, we don't even really understand it. You can't. The reason we're not on that platform is that we can't even. If you understand the concept of paradigms, it's outside of our paradigm. And there's Atmaman Manyachayagat. We understand everyone else according to ourselves. So if I see someone operating on a higher platform, I interpret their behavior and their motives as if they were on my platform. So it's very hard to even recognize people that are on a much higher platform than ourselves, to really understand how they're operating. So there's a tendency when you see someone on a higher platform to say, oh, well, they're really, what's motivating them is like this. Like Prabhupada gives the example that if you find out some childhood friend of yours became a high court judge, and you say, no, he couldn't be, no, please. No, no, really he is. Well, he must not be getting paid. So that mentality. No, there can't be anybody who's advanced. Sometimes you'll hear that. You hear people say, oh, everybody in the Hare Krishna movement is a neophyte. There's no advanced devotees. And I'm sorry, I know some of the advanced devotees in the Hare Krishna movement. Some of them have big titles and positions, and some of them are sweeping the floor. So when I say bring people down, I mostly mean in that way. Although you can also, if someone's in power, you can also bring people down if you're bad association. That is also possible. You know? We talk about that as far as negative peer pressure in the world in general, that in order to like people and get along with them, you may give up your principles. So we can pull people down in that way to try to convince them to do things that are against their better judgment. Oh, come on, you can just do it one time. It's not a big deal. You know, you're always so strict. You're such a fuddy-duddy. Why do you have to always be so strict? Or mocking people, that's another way of bringing people down. Do you really have to just chant now? I mean, look at you, goody, 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 chanting all the time. That's what kids do, but adults have ways of doing that, of mocking people and making them feel uncomfortable or strange because they're on the higher platform. Okay, I definitely should end now. Thank you very much. All the best to you.